History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. By age 22, George Washington was acclaimed as a hero. As a commander of the Virginia Regiment, he gave orders to men decades older than himself. He was good at most things he tried, and his name was known throughout British North America and England. Yet his military career came to ashes when he was 27. His life is a story of reinvention from early missteps, culminating in his unanimous election as the nation's first president. But how did Washington emerge from a military leader to the highest office in the country? Today's guest is David O. Stewart, author of the new book, George Washington, The Political Rise of America's Founding Father. And we look at the wilderness years of George Washington and why Washington has often been portrayed as less eloquent and politically savvy than his peers. But Stewart argues that Washington's political skills were second to none. He wasn't as learned as a John Adams or Thomas Jefferson and couldn't quote from memory long passages in Latin or Greek, and he had a tougher childhood than some of the more upper-crusted landed gentry, having to spend weeks as a surveyor when he was a teenager and camping out in the wilderness. But from Virginia's House of Burgesses, where Washington learned the craft and timing of a practicing politician, to his management of local government as a justice of the Fairfax County Court, to his eventual role in the Second Continental Congress and his grueling generalship of the American Revolution, Washington perfected the art of governing and service, earned trust, and building bridges. And the lessons in leadership he absorbed along the way proved invaluable during the early years of the Republic as he fought to unify the nation. So we're going to be looking at well-known chapters in his life, like leading his army through the winter of despair at Valley Forge in 1778, leading the new federal government that was created from next to nothing, but also lesser-known chapters like guarding the bargain for a financial program that restored the nation's credit and kept America from insolvency, also keeping America out of the European War that followed the French Revolution. And finally, in his final years, he struggled with slavery and hoped to point his countrymen toward repentance and even redemption. So a lot to unpack here, looking at the wilderness years and other less explored chapters of George Washington's life. And I hope you enjoyed this discussion with David Stewart. David, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Well, this will be a good discussion because George Washington has come up many times in this podcast, and many have noted that he was less eloquent than his peers. I mean, he was a member of the landed gentry, to be sure, but he was still had some of the rough edges of somebody who, as a teenager, worked as a land surveyor and spent weeks in the outdoors compared to other founding fathers who could quote passages from Greek or Latin at length. But one of the main points in your book is that Washington's political skills were second to none. So are there any anecdotes that jump out to you from his life that you think demonstrate this succinctly?
Yeah, there's a bunch. I wrote a whole book about it. But, you know, I think some obvious ones are in early 1783, the army is rusticating. Frankly, they're very dissatisfied. They haven't been paid. They're not being treated very well. There's really no war left to fight. And there is a real risk of mutiny, very serious risk of mutiny. And the officers are circulating statements among themselves demanding, you know, that they do something or, and frankly, just abandon the cause. And Washington takes over a public meeting that has been convened not by him and manages to touch them in a way. And it's not what we think of as the great leader's oratory with, you know, a stem winding denunciation. It's a human moment where he reaches them on a human level. And that is a gift he had, which I think people don't realize and don't notice so much. He had a tremendous talent for reading people, for getting them to tell him what was on their mind, and he didn't tell them what was on his mind. And the mutiny just fizzled after he gave his talk. Another occasion, there's this key moment in the new government under the Constitution when there's a big fight over the financial plan to repay the country's huge debts and over where the national capital would be. And this comes to us by myth written by Thomas Jefferson that it was all settled at a dinner that Jefferson hosted. He is, of course, because he tells the story, the hero of the story, where Hamilton and Madison made the deal. And I think when you look at it closely, they probably had dinner, but and they probably talked about it, but that wasn't the key moment. The key player in all of this was Washington, that he was pushing the parties all along. And, you know, let's look around the table. Madison was his closest ally politically, and Jefferson and Hamilton essentially worked for him. So they're cutting the deal for him. And when you look at what the deal was, the financial plan got approved. The national capital went to Washington, to the Potomac, to what we now know as Washington, D.C. Hamilton didn't like the capital going to the Potomac. Jefferson didn't like the financial plan. Madison hated the financial plan. The only guy who got everything he wanted was Washington. He wanted both. So, you know, nobody pays much attention to the fact that he was the guy pulling the strings and he was the guy who won. And it over and over, you find that he has this talent for understanding what people need and how to move them.
That's a good point on his gift is not oratory, but intuition and empathy, because the stories about him that stick out, many of which you just mentioned, aren't a speech he gives. He's not like a Daniel Webster that is famous and remembered for his oratory or a speech, but anecdotes about him, accounts by others about him, how they were impacted by him. And one of the points that you make is that the reason he stands out is because of the comeback that he makes. He's a wunderkind who has a fantastic rise as a young man at 22. He's a hero, and then he has a staggering fall from grace at 27. So could you set the stage there?
Yes, he's this big athletic guy who, as you suggested, knows the frontier. He's been out in the woods a lot, and he's tough. And he goes on a couple of very dangerous missions to deal with the French when the English and the French are sinking into the French and Indian War, which arguably Washington started. And he is a great hero for his early exploits. Then the contest sinks into this fighting on the frontier led by Indian tribes who are spectacular forest fighters, and the whites are terrible at it. And they just lose. And you know, there's the terrible debacle when Braddock leads an army into the wilderness that's slaughtered. And just, you know, week in and week out, Washington is unsuccessful, and he distraught over it. He starts behaving badly towards his superiors. He alienates them. He really fouls his own nest. And after 4 years, he leaves the military with essentially not many friends left there. And he heads off in a new direction. And he heads off to become a planter, to be the head of Mount Vernon, the squire of Mount Vernon, but also to be a political figure. He runs for the House of Burgesses and wins. That's the Virginia Colonial Assembly, and he reinvents himself. He's not a well-educated man. He lacks most of the learning that contemporaries in the elite had, but he's a lifelong self-learner. He reads all the time, and he studies, and he worries about improving himself. There's a moment I love when he first becomes president, when he writes a good friend back in Virginia and says, "Please tell me what people are talking about there, but particularly tell me what they are saying bad about me, because I need to know that, because either I'm not explaining myself well, or maybe I need to change what I'm doing." Now, that's a great thing for a leader to ask, and not that enough leaders have the modesty and humility to be open about that.
Right. And I think I'd like to dwell on this point here before we look at some of these treacherous episodes that you focus on in the book that are more well known, because we're entering George Washington's wilderness years, where he has a fantastic rise and then things go poorly for him and he has to come back. And by the time the Revolutionary War begins, he's back on the national stage. He did things to get back there. And he's not alone as a great leader who had wilderness years. Winston Churchill did after World War One. His party was out of power for decades. Abraham Lincoln did. Many prominent leaders like this had wilderness years. So could you tell me about his wilderness years and beyond what you just mentioned, what allows him to get back? So by the time the Revolutionary War happens, he's picked as a national figure who can help lead this movement.
Sure. That's a real focus for the book, and at one level, even the justification for it, because those wilderness years, and there's 16 years between when he leaves the military in the French and Indian War, and he appears at the First Continental Congress in Philadelphia in 1774, when he transforms himself. And some of it's internal, of course, some of it's getting older. A lot of us get a little smarter when we get older. But also, as I was saying, set out to learn about himself and about how to function in the world. And he spent 16 years in the House of Burgesses. He was a legislator 5 years longer than he was in a military uniform. He spent 6 years as a judge on the Fairfax County Court. But, you know, he wasn't a lawyer. It wasn't all that judicial a job, although there were cases he had to decide. It actually was a local government job. They set taxes, they built the roads, they took care of the county. He also was on the church vestry board, and in Virginia, in colonial times, the vestry board took care of the poor people in the county. And that was his graduate school in politics, those three places where he became very engaged. And it's a process. When he first starts in the House of Burgesses, he's not very impressive. There's a long episode. It's not that long, but there's an episode I got through where he tries to carry legislation through the House of Burgesses to restrict the free running of pigs in Winchester, Virginia, which is in his district. Pigs, if they're just running around, are very destructive. They also sort of leave their messes. They don't have very good etiquette. And it's uncivilized having them run around. So they just wanted to require that people pen their pigs. He couldn't get it through the House of Burgesses. Finally, somebody takes it over for him, renames the bill, how to ensure pure water in the city of Winchester. And as a new environmental bill in the 18th century, it sails through the House of Burgesses. And he learns from these episodes. And you can see over this 16-year career in the legislature, he slowly gets more responsibility. And he takes responsibility for militia issues because he's the military guy. Then he takes responsibility for paying the militia. Okay, now he's getting into finance. Then he starts getting involved in financial issues, and that's the lifeblood of any institution, any organization. And finally, when the conflict breaks out with Britain in the early 1770s, he's a serious guy. He's somebody people listen to. And it's because he's done the work. It's because he's taken the time to learn the issues, and he's made personal connections with all the people who matter. It's a very fascinating process to watch him basically scrabble back from the edge and recreate himself. You know, the old saying, it doesn't matter if you get knocked down, it's how you get up. Washington and the other individuals you mentioned are illustrations of that.
And that's a great point, because starting the story at Valley Forge misses that he was doing unglamorous work for decades. It's funny to hear that story. I didn't know it, where he's dealing with a county ordinance about pigs and failing. We imagine him as this giant imposing figure who's beating 20-year-old soldiers at athletic competitions as this towering commanding presence. But here he is as a younger man who's failing at county health regulations. The exact same things, except in a much larger context, come up later. So that's a great point. And with that in mind, as he's taking these lessons from much more unglamorous circumstances and then applying them in settings that we do know about, I'd love to hear about some of the main episodes that you cover in your book where he's taking these lessons of governing and service and earning trust and building bridges and applying them. You touched on Valley Forge at the beginning of the episode, but can you go into more detail about how he brings the army through this winter and he is also thwarting this attempt to be superseded as commander-in-chief and then winning the battle at Monmouth Courthouse?
Sure. When the army reaches Valley Forge in late 1777, they've had 2 years of grinding defeats. They haven't really had a good inning for 2 years. And it's cold. And at the same time, their supply mechanisms just totally seize up. They break down, and there are reasons for it, which I won't go into here. And, you know, you can look at the commander-in-chief and say, well, this is on your watch, pal. You should have been managing this. And he realizes immediately that this is unacceptable, that the army is not going to last if he can't fix this. And he needs support from Congress. He always recognized that he worked for Congress. He may have been commander-in-chief of the army, but Congress was the voice of the people. They were in charge. And so he manages to persuade people in Congress to send a committee to help him with this issue. And six congressmen come at a time when there's probably only 20 delegates in actually present at Congress. And they stay at Valley Forge for more than a month and work through these supply issues with the quartermaster, with the commissary, with the clothier general. And they appreciate both how bad the problems are, how much the soldiers are suffering. And that may be the most important thing they see, is how much the soldiers are suffering. And they come with enough solutions that the army begins to pull together. At the same time, he's fighting essentially a bureaucratic knife fight with some other senior commanders who want his job. Particularly, there's an effort to put Horatio Gates in his position. Gates has won this tremendous triumph at Saratoga. And a lot of people are saying, well, if Gates can win that, why don't we give him the whole army? And Washington is very crafty. He doesn't take Gates on directly. He bides his time. He waits for the people who are after him, and it's called the Conway Cabal, to overplay their hand. And he ultimately musters enough support in Congress that they are completely undone. So he gets control of the army then. And the third major step is this bizarre German shows up. We know him as General von Steuben, although he may only have been a much lower officer in Europe, who has been sent over. We had a lot of Europeans come to this country and offer to help us. They were looking, you know, they were professional soldiers. There was a war going on, so they wanted to, you know, advance their careers. Von Steuben shows up and is a totally winning professional guy who also doesn't show much ego, and he takes over the training of the army, even though he speaks very little English. And unit by unit, he retrains the army, which has never really learned how to be soldiers. They haven't had time. There's this almost ideological resistance to it among the Americans, that this notion that standing armies are dangerous to liberty, so you only want the militia to fight. Citizen soldiers is the answer. Well, it turns out citizen soldiers often run away when the battle starts. And you need people who have been trained to stand and fight in terrible circumstances. And von Steuben just totally remakes the army. So there is, as they get into the fighting season, which is the summer of 1778, Washington knows he's got to win a battle. It's been 2 years. He also knows that the French have just signed an alliance with us, which is a huge advantage. That gives the whole army and the nation hope. So he stalks the British as they're trying to leave Philadelphia and get back to New York. He stalks them across New Jersey and finally is able to confront them really at the last moment before they reach safety. And the battle is at Monmouth Courthouse. It's an improvised battle. Washington actually sometimes did better with improvised battles than with planned battles. He could overthink things. And if he didn't, he sometimes was much more effective. And the Americans won. And it was just a huge moment. And it gave heart to the army, gave heart to the cause. And to be honest, it gave heart to Washington.
Right. And that aspect of his career as a spy master with the Culper spy ring and the Knowlton's Rangers, that's something I've always been a fan of. So I'm glad you could bring that up. Then the other issue, too, is at the end of the war, you focus on this as well in your book, where you're persuading unpaid soldiers, many of them are mutinying, and officers to lay down their arms and embrace peace in 1783, and then resolve the political chaos with a new constitution in 1787. How does he navigate those issues. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Well, there's a key moment which we really can't ever overlook at the end of 1783 when the army has finally gone home, terribly disgruntled. They haven't been paid well. Washington is very angry about this as well because he knows what the sacrifices his soldiers have gone through. And he has a choice, which victorious generals have faced throughout human history. And most of them decide, well, I'll just take over, which is what Julius Caesar did. It's what Napoleon was going to do, what Simon Bolivar did, Oliver Cromwell. Pretty attractive. You've got the power. Everything else is sort of falling apart. And Washington did this remarkable thing, which was he said, I'm going home. And he resigned and he gave up power. And there's a famous anecdote that when King George III heard this, pretty much didn't believe it. But he said, if that's true, he's the greatest man in the world. Because nobody gives up power like that. But George Washington did. And as a result, he won the trust of Americans. They didn't have to be afraid of giving power to Washington because he wasn't crazy for it. He would give it back if he didn't need it and if there was no reason for him to have it. The country then, without his being the central figure, for a couple of years has a terrible time. The states had formed a loose confederacy under the Articles of Confederation. They couldn't do much. The economy was in terrible shape. It was probably our worst economic depression ever, even worse than the depression of the 1930s. And there was a real risk the country would fall apart. And people like Madison and Hamilton are agitating for a convention to create a new government that would be more effective. Washington is not at the forefront of this. He likes being home at Mount Vernon. They essentially talk him into doing it. He goes to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. He's immediately elected president of the convention by a unanimous vote. He's selected to leadership positions five times in his life, all by unanimous votes. And in the 18th century, that was a pretty amazing thing. Today, it would be too, but it was astonishing. And he makes it clear by the things he has been saying for the last couple of years, and he's been writing letters to friends and being clear that the government has to be stronger. And his demands are simple. That's one of the characteristics of Washington. He is clear and simple in what he thinks needs to be done. It's not a 12-point program. That the new it's straightforward. The new government has to have the power to levy taxes, which it didn't have. It has to have an executive branch, which it didn't have. And it has to have power, greater power than the states. Because if the states were running things, they were going to get into arguments with each other and the country would fall apart, because that's what was happening. Those were the three essential things he needed from the new government that he made it clear. And that's what they got. So there's no question this central role. You know, I wrote a book about the writing of the Constitution. He didn't write any passages. He wasn't part of the debates because he was presiding. And he would never be part of the debates. He didn't like that sort of thing. He was shy about it. He thought he wasn't very good at it. But it was his leadership, his clear vision of what needed to be done, that they all understood and they all made happen.
With that, too, you set the stage earlier in the episode talking about gaining political experience in the House of Burgesses and knowing when to step into debates, when to step out of them and be more of a unifying figure. One part of his legacy that maybe isn't focused on as much is helping restore the nation's credit and keeping it solvent, which budget solvency isn't as sexy of a topic as leading an army through a victorious war. But if your nation's not solvent, then you go bankrupt and it doesn't exist. And I can imagine all of his politicking in the House of Burgesses helped him do that. So how did he guide a bargain for the financial program that kept the new nation solvent?
Well, you raise a great point, because it's worth spending a second on the fact that he was always anxious about money. It's something, as a teenager, his family had not been wealthy. They'd had a bad time after his father died. And his mother was very anxious about money. George was very anxious about money. It's something she sort of conveyed to him. And consequently, he was pretty conservative, as that term would be used, on financial matters for the country. And it was critical. We had $70 million worth of debts. This is between the central government and the states, for an economy that was not very large. And it was a crushing load. And it had to be dealt with. And Hamilton almost always gets all the credit for dealing with this. And he should get a lot of it. He did put together the program that dealt with the debts and created a workable system. And there were some basic principles he came up with, which were that we would honor every debt. We might not pay as much interest as we had said we would, because there just was only so much money. And we would pay the debts back slowly. And that was for two reasons. One was so the people who were getting those debt payments would want the government to succeed, because they liked getting those debt payments. The other was that all of that debt paper, and this is slightly mysterious to non-economists, could circulate in the economy and serve as a sort of surrogate currency. And it was Hamilton's structure, but we've got to recognize that it was Washington's policy. And he reviewed it, he adopted it, and then, as you suggest, he had to figure out a way to get it adopted, enacted by Congress. And that was the deal I was talking about before, where they essentially were able to trade Southern votes for the financial plan and pick up some Northern votes for putting the national capital on the Potomac River. And each piece of the bargain passed by only a few votes, but both were enacted. And it was essentially the first foundation of the government.
And at this point in history, it's very important to have your house in order. I am a scholar of the Ottoman Empire. This is an empire that does not have its financial house in order. And if you don't, then there are plenty of foreign creditors willing to swirl around and, in exchange for them loaning you money, have more say in your affairs. So with the Ottomans, for example, by the 1800s, the British essentially control their domestic affairs. So, and Washington, on a personal aside, had his own finances mostly in order, which for many people who only casually look at the founding generation, it's always a little baffling, because it seems like one person, on the one hand, has thousands of acres of land, on the other hand, is constantly into land speculation and gambling and completely bankrupt. It seems like there are these two things at the same time all over the place. So Washington has a little bit more balance than many other people at the time. Well, something else that he does that is very critical at the beginning of the United States, Washington, and then followed up by John Adams, is that he keeps America out of the European war following the French Revolution. And there are people who are, there are supporters of France and Britain in the United States, and there's this sort of partisan support of these different nations, but Washington keeps the balance. How does he do this?
It's a fascinating moment in our history, and I was just trying to think as you were talking, is there another time where our domestic politics were so divided based on which foreign country we thought we wanted to be closest to? And I'm not sure it was. It was a unique moment, and I think a reflection of how weak we were, how small we were, how new we were. But there was a tremendous division between those who had an emotional tie to France as having basically saved us during the Revolutionary War, which they did. We might not have won that war without the French alliance. And also going through their own revolution and embracing the cause that we had embraced. And those who were looking at Britain as, first of all, where our institutions and traditions really came from, despite the war for independence, and as the nation with whom we did 90% of our trade. So it was terribly important to our economic success. So Washington always insisted that when you're figuring out a political situation, people follow their interest. And by that, he meant their self-interest. You can count on ideology and on idealism for a short time, but only a short time. Sooner or later, they're going to vote essentially their pocketbook. And he decided that, first of all, we had to have peace with Britain. Now, France and Britain, by the early 1790s, have gone to war with each other. This is the fallout from the Revolution. It's also a manifestation of the 110 years of wars they'd been fighting before then. And each is trying to manipulate American trade in a way to support their cause. And they're both seizing our cargoes, taking our sailors, being very harsh towards Americans. But Washington decides we have to have peace with Britain. He'd like to have peace with France, but he's got to have it with Britain. So he sends John Jay, who was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, to Britain to negotiate a treaty. We had a number of outstanding issues. And the treaty Jay gets is not so great. We were weak. Britain was at a in a war. They didn't really care to give away a lot. But it meant peace if we signed it. And it was very controversial. And Washington knew it when he got the treaty from Jay. And he's, quite frankly, quite manipulative. This is not a guy who believed in the modern standards of transparency. He did not release the treaty for almost 4 months after he received it. So nobody really knew what was in it. And he waited for events to move in his favor, an opinion to move in his favor. When it was finally released, he turned out he hadn't waited quite long enough. And there's a firestorm of protest. I think Jay said that he could have walked across the country but by the light of the burning effigies of his image. And Washington has to decide whether to stick with this. He decides he really has to. His allies are hung out on the issue. He is hung out on the issue, and he decides he will stand by the treaty. But then again, he works on his timing, and he holds back on a key vote in Congress that to finance the parts, the elements of the treaty. And he holds back, and he holds back, and he holds back until finally the opponents sort of shout themselves out. And they lose momentum. Then there's a wonderful treaty that's signed with Spain, which opens up the Mississippi River to our people out west, which is a huge win. And suddenly everybody's feeling pretty good about the Washington administration, and Washington strikes. And he sends his moves the legislation through Congress, and he gets what he needs. And we do get 15 years of peace with Britain, which were essential. Now, the French aren't very happy about it, and that turns out to be the problem that John Adams has to deal with in his administration, and you talk about that. And he does finally resolve that as well. But this was really a minefield that, you know, America didn't need another war. It was, you know, we had been devastated by the Revolutionary War. We made the mistake of having the war fought on our land, which is always a mistake, that you get all the collateral damage. And preserving the peace was essential to preserving the republic.
Well, the final issue that you touch on, and this maybe has the most contemporary significance in 2021, because there's been a lot of discussion about the founding of the United States, how race has to deal with it. Are there lingering legacies of this? And something you touch on is in Washington's final years, he's dealing with slavery and wants to point his countrymen toward repentance and even redemption. The issue of constitutionally, even though there is language of the equality of all people, that's of course not the case for slaves. Emancipation doesn't come for decades later, and there's a debate of, well, the Founding Fathers, they pushed things forward, and they at least signed a check that was later cashed that made emancipation possible. Others disagree. So what's your take on all this in your book? Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
It's a terrible situation, and I try to be candid about it. My impression and conclusion was that for the first until Washington goes off to war and the Revolutionary War, he is not very troubled about slavery. There's not much evidence of it. It seems to be part of his life, and he just more or less accepts it. He advances some of his enslaved workers, gives them greater responsibility, a few privileges, but there's not a lot to point to say that he was especially sensitive or enlightened. I think the war changed him because of African-American soldiers who fought with him, who died in his service. And he could not ignore the hypocrisy of these black people dying to preserve his liberty. And then he was going to go back home and own them. And he becomes troubled by it. He tries a few strategies. He decides he'll be a good slave owner and, you know, not break up families and that sort of thing. And he's not very good at that because, as I mentioned, he's always anxious about money. And if he's in a bad, tight spot and turns out he can sell a slave and get out of the tight spot, he's tempted to do it. And he realizes as more time goes on that it's just not working. He's not improving his situation and he's got to deal with it. And the last 10 years of his life, he is trying to figure a way out for himself. He keeps saying that we need legislation. You know, the northern states were starting to adopt gradual emancipation laws, which allowed the freeing of slaves when they hit certain ages. And it was a lot easier in the northern states because there were a lot fewer slaves. In the south, it never really was a realistic solution, although Washington kept recommending it. For himself, he owned 50, 60,000 acres in what was then the West, mostly in West Virginia, which he kept wanting to sell off and take the money and to use to emancipate his slaves. He had a particular problem that Martha Washington, his wife, had control of even more slaves than he did from her first husband. And those are called the Custis Dower slaves. And those Dower slaves were beyond his power to free. She had a legal obligation to preserve their value for her grandchildren under the law at the time. So he couldn't just free them. He had to essentially buy them out of the estate of her first husband. So that's what he was trying to do, was raise enough money to do it. And it was going to be a lot of money because essentially you're talking about 150 people or so. He never was able to do it. He couldn't sell the land. He was land poor. It was the wrong time. There was not demand for land in the West because of fears of Indian attack. And in his final year of life, he realized that he wasn't going to be able to make it happen. So he wrote a new will. And in his will, he freed his own slaves on his death, although he provided that they would not become free until Martha died, which was a pretty standard clause for emancipating slaves by will, although it had a downside, because then the widow is sitting there at the plantation surrounded by people who really want her to die. And if they're preparing your food, it creates a lot of anxiety about getting poisoned. So she actually does free the slaves during her lifetime, and he provides for them, which is pretty unique. He provides enough money to support the old ones and enough money to educate the children until they can take their place in the world. And fascinating thing he does is he expects them to settle nearby. One of the things that some of the founding fathers got enamored of was this notion of colonization. We'll just take all these freed slaves and we'll send them back to Africa. You know, this 200 years they've been in this country, they don't have a clue about Africa and they don't want to go. But this was to be the solution, largely because they couldn't imagine, the founders couldn't imagine, a multiracial society. They knew how racist the people, the whites, were, and they just didn't think the slaves could have any kind of life here. Washington faced up to that. He did not fall for this fantasy of colonization, and it was a fantasy. And he insisted that they were going to take their place in American society. So his slaves were emancipated. His estate paid for some of them for over 30 years after his death. I see his action as much more a personal atonement. I think he would have hoped that it would inspire other Americans, but he was too hard-headed a guy to really believe that.
Well, you're touching in your book on a figure that has been researched extensively, but your goal is to influence how people perceive Washington, and I think also take away lessons from his life. So how do you hope that your book influences the perception of Washington, and what message do you hope readers take away from it?
To be really crude, I think it's essential that we start saying out loud in public that politicians are good. Our problem is not that we have politicians. Our problem is that sometimes our politicians are bad. And a good politician, by which I mean someone who listens to people, someone who builds consensus, somebody who maintains idealism, who respects others, can make a huge difference. I mean, that's why we have these people as heroes. And, you know, it's been ingrained in American society for all of our history, but it seems especially acute these days. All politicians are crooks. All politicians are dopey. Let's just burn them all down. And that's so terribly wrong, because human society is way too complex to live without political structures, to live without governments, and to live without good politicians. And we have to pay attention to who they are and stop complaining that they actually picked this job and are trying to serve the people.
Well, that's a great point. And it's very, very, very easy to be cynical about our political process, but there are people who are aspirational, and that's something you touch on. And for readers who want to get more into all the things we discussed, the name of your new book is George Washington, The Political Rise of America's Founding Father. David, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, that is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group. And here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.